Do you want more true crime bedtime stories? Sign up to Bonus Bedtime Stories on Apple Podcasts today to access early and ad-free episodes. Subscribers will also get an exclusive bonus episode each month. But for now, get comfortable and enjoy tonight's episode.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to True Crime Bedtime Stories. In today's episode, we'll cover the scandalous life of Houston socialite Candace Mosler, unwrap the mystery of her husband's murder, and explore the trials and drama that followed. We'll dive into the tangled web of wealth, deceit, and the pursuit of truth. Join us as we journey into the past, shedding light on a story that reveals the dark undercurrents flowing beneath a mask of high society glamour. Settle in as we peel back the layers of this riveting case and ask ourselves, what secrets lie hidden in the shadows of opulence? We embark on our narrative in the vibrant era of the mid-60s, where the name Candace Mosler commanded attention as a sterling icon amidst Houston's creme de la creme. Her allure captivated the sophisticated echelons with an enchanting cascade of wavy blonde tendrils, eyes reminiscent of the deep blue sea, and a stately aura that could effortlessly dominate any grand room she adorned. Recognized widely for her enchanting charm and spirit, Candace stood as the epitome of elegance and charm, the hostess beyond compare. Her events, especially the grandiose fundraisers, pulsated with vigor and zest, traits uniquely attributable to a personage of her illustrious social rank. The opulence and spirited buzz of her galas marked the high points of the social calendar. Her residence, infamous for its grandiose parties, was a topic of legend. The upper echelons of Houston society would wait with bated breath for the coveted invitations, the opportunity to immerse oneself in the radiant aura of wealth, and the prospect of fraternizing with luminaries and musicians like Chuck Berry himself, who would often be enlisted to add glitz to the entertainment at her expansive estate. Every social engagement was meticulously crafted by Candace to surpass its predecessor in extravagance, ranging from her cinematic, enthralling entrances as she descended the spiraled staircase, to the glimmering diamond adornments that, in the twinkling of the lights, established her as the undeniable centerpiece of every event. Candace was also the glittering jewel at the center of her family, as portrayed in regular magazine spreads and features in the society pages. She and her husband had been childless until he called her from a business trip in Chicago. Having read a desperately sad news story about four children orphaned by family violence, Candace flew to the city that very day, and together they adopted all four, three boys and a girl. From then on, the children, aged from 2 to 6 years old, were the envy of every child in Houston, with lavish birthday parties and frequent holidays in Florida, all reported breathlessly by the local media. But beneath the surface, behind the immaculate and seemingly flawless facade, there existed a world far more intricate, complex, and bewildering than the public could ever perceive. A shadowy world of hidden truths and discreetly hushed whispers where nothing was as it seemed. Candace's carefully crafted life of aspirational opulence was poised to unravel in the most shocking of circumstances. The belle of Houston's high society, radiant and graceful, might have floated elegantly through the great rooms and grand gardens of her River Oaks mansion, her infectious charisma enchanting a captivated parade of well-heeled guests. But her seemingly perfect marriage was far from the storybook fairy tale. Her husband, Jack Mosler, was significantly older than she, a man of considerable and respected financial acumen within high economic circles. He commanded controlling interests in multiple prestigious banks, high-stake loan companies, and influential insurance firms. Jack was very relaxed talking business with other men of his caliber, but he grew increasingly uncomfortable attending his wife's grand pageants. Candace, ever popular and sought after in high society, found herself all too often alone amidst her own glittering gatherings, with Jack being a spectral, elusive absence at her extravagantly opulent soirees, leaving her the role of the most dazzling of hosts without the affirming presence of her spouse. A partner who decidedly and unabashedly preferred the silent, calculating shadows of the financial world to the overbearing spectacle of social events and celebrations. This provocatively growing distance between them, an unwelcome divider, gave fertile rise to persistent whispers. Those hushed, insistent tones of conjecture and speculation that aimed to fill the void left by Candace and Jack's silence. Persistent, unrelenting rumors of extramarital entanglements and covert, secretive affairs began to insidiously circulate with more fervor, effectively sketching a tantalizing portrait of a union so intricately intertwined with the most intimate of hidden secrets and an elaborate array of deceptions. It was amidst this complex, intricate tapestry of their lives, where the anesthetic luster of high society appeal only just managed to quell the rising speculation of disharmony, that the dark, ominous undercurrents started to slowly emerge, forebodingly heralding a time that would indeed see this once illustrious couple become the unwitting protagonists in a scandal so intensely compelling, so sensationally captivating, it was ultimately destined to command and captivate the entire nation's rapt attention. The tranquil beach community of Key Biscayne in Florida was shaken to its very core by a spectacle of horror on an otherwise serene summer morning in June of 1964. Jack Mosler, a Houston tycoon who was renowned perhaps more for his sharp financial acumen than for being a fixture on the social circuits, was found deceased. His body was a silent witness to an especially heinous attack that left the once ornate living space of his luxury oceanfront condominium horrendously smeared with the stark, undeniable colors of a calamitously violent intrusion. For the detectives who arrived first at the crime scene, the overwhelming disarray before their eyes spoke alarming volumes of an attempt at thievery that had gone badly wrong. Jack's billfold was found devoid of cash, with his once prized belongings carelessly strewn about without the least bit of consideration or care. Candace was very forthcoming with information for the police. She told them her husband had made many business enemies over the years. His business associates, however, disputed this characterization and pondered openly how that could be true without any of them having heard anything about it, either from Jack himself or through the grapevine. They held that Jack had an impeccable reputation in the business community. Candace countered that they didn't know Jack like she did. For instance, she knew that when he was alone in Florida, Jack invited young men he met at the beach back to spend time with him in their apartment. In fact, she said that the week before he died, when she and the children had been with him there, Jack had received phone calls from a man she didn't know who spoke in feminine tones. Police were open about their doubts that the attack was random. This attack took time, they said, and it was a display of significant violence. There was, they believed, some kind of personal motive involved in this crime. Could there really have been something even more deeply unsettling beneath the surface of this murder? Could it have been the culmination of dark secrets that the eyes of casual observers and even those who considered themselves close friends had never noticed before? You should know, dear listener, that Candace was not the only mourner eager to share information with the police. Within days of Jack's brutal execution, investigators were made aware of rumors that his wife had been, for the previous 2 years, in a romantic relationship with a handsome 22-year-old mobile home salesman by the name of Mel Powers, who was also her nephew. Jack, they were told, had recently become aware of the relationship himself and had banished Mel from the mansion. And so the rigorous inquiry commenced in the unrelenting, oppressive Floridian heat, with detectives persistently sifting through the countless shards of a once immaculate existence, now tragically shattered. The truth, as inherently elusive and captivating as the shimmering waves incessantly crashing ashore, patiently waited to be unraveled amidst the enigmatic murmurings of the ever-swaying palms in the gentle breeze. They were beginning to tell haunting tales of the truth behind a mask, meticulously maintained, which now lay cracked and weathered in the unforgiving sun. The particularly sinister murder implement, a steel blade that had repeatedly and viciously stabbed the life out of Jack Mosler, remained elusive and is to this day undiscovered. Its absence in the investigation left behind a mysterious and haunting tale that thrust Jack's very own spouse, Candace, in conjunction with her nephew and lover, Mel Powers, into the glaring and unforgiving spotlight of grim criminal accusation. Beside them stood long-standing business associates and anonymous beach acquaintances, invoking a heady mix of glamour, scandal, and horror for public consumption. Financial dealings and steamy love letters were devoured daily, along with the inevitable rumors, including some Candace thought she'd put behind her forever with her sophisticated parties and charitable donations. The unseemly gossip that had nipped at Candace's heels during her earliest days in Houston about where she'd come from and who she'd been before her sudden arrival on the social scene reappeared with a vengeance. This time, though, the stories weren't whispered in polite company over cocktails and canapés. They were printed in newspapers and dissected by serious television hosts. Had Candace been a call girl in the French Quarter of New Orleans? Was that how she and Jack met? These stories gained momentum when it was revealed that Candace stood to inherit Jack's entire estate, which was valued at $7 million, around $60 million in today's money. In the year that followed the murder, the myriad facets of the life and times of Jack and Candace were systematically presented for scrutiny. Revelation after revelation emerged from beneath what proved to have been a fragile pretense of family life. It was all paraded before an unmerciful world in painstaking detail via the media, but as Candace and her four children knelt by Jack's graveside to place roses by the headstone on the first anniversary of his death, it seemed the official investigation had gone decidedly cold. Just 3 weeks later, though, the Dade County Prosecutor's Office made the stunning announcement that both Candace and Mel had been indicted for the murder of Jack Mosler. The trial began in Miami in 1966, and such was the anticipated interest level around the country that the New York Daily News covered the walls of the city's subway stations with posters promising daily coverage of the Candy Mosler murder trial. In retrospect, it could be said that this trial set the standard in many ways for all the high-profile celebrity proceedings that followed. Candace arrived every day dressed to the nines in designer clothes and sky-high heels. She stopped and posed demurely with her lawyer for the wall of cameras awaiting her as she stepped from her limousine before walking inside to the lifts in the rhythmic, deliberate way of a catwalk model. The courtroom, abuzz with a palpable heightened anticipation that reverberated through its storied walls, was impeccably arranged and set to host what promised to be an exceedingly memorable and extraordinary trial. The gallery packed to the gills with an excited audience, many of whom had lined up for hours hoping for a seat. With an eager array of seasoned journalists squeezing into the increasingly crowded wooden benches, the trial was about to take place, and it guaranteed all of the trappings and elements of a sensationalized pulp fiction narrative. The prosecutors meticulously presented their masterfully crafted and elaborate narrative, skillfully weaving together a complex theory spun from the potent, durable threads of unbounded greed, tightly coupled with the scandal of unabashed, forbidden lust. A provocative and lurid tale wherein a woman, outwardly the picture-perfect epitome of high societal gracefulness, together with her youthful, vigorous young paramour, bearing an air of determination, embarked on a route enveloping a chillingly methodical and clinical premeditated act of murder. Not to be outdone, the defense, adroitly marshaled by the esteemed, imposing, and formidable litigator Percy Forman, cleverly positioned themselves as unwavering bastions of justice, standing firmly against a seemingly unwarranted and egregious rush to a sleazy and scandal-mongering judgment. They persisted with resolute determination in arguing that the state, in its case against their clients, had liberally and unfairly adorned their portrayals with broad, scandalous strokes and a penchant for overt and unnecessary sensationalism. Forman's savvy defense strategy was inherently complex and multifaceted, and far from limited strictly to a barrage of factual rebuttals. Instead, it was purposefully designed as an intricate, fierce counteroffensive, deftly setting Percy Forman's seasoned legal acumen and formidable sights upon the victim himself, Jack Mosler. Jack was a figure consistently portrayed as exceedingly powerful, yet emphatically and universally despised, a well-established, storied financier surrounded by a plethora of potential adversaries who might have very well lived a life mysterious, shrouded in the most profound of abundant secrets and in the murky waters of undisclosed, perhaps sinister, endeavors. Forman's oratory skills were thoroughly mesmerizing. He seduced the members of the courtroom with a powerfully resonant baritone timbre, intricately weaving a persuasive alternative reality so convincingly that even the onlookers and jurors who were once solidly convinced of the unquestionable guilt of both Candace and Mel began to be riddled with doubts regarding their convictions. Throughout the extended and often tumultuous duration of the trial, Forman's bold assertions and strong suggestions managed to gradually crack the firm veneer of what initially appeared to be a straightforward and simple case, continuously implying and hinting at complex plots, within even more complex plots, a densely layered resentment, and deep-seated acts of betrayal that possibly ran so much deeper than anyone present could have ever feasibly ascertained or comprehended in that courtroom. Although he had not a skerrick of proof, Forman declared that Jack Mosler possessed every conceivable sex deviation that anybody has ever had. He had an insatiable sex appetite for high school boys and college students. He spent time in bars frequented by gay people. Why? If each of the 39 wounds on the body of the deceased had been inflicted by a separate person, that is, 39 different people, Forman declared, there still would be three times as many people in the state of Florida with enough reason to want the death of Jack Mosler. Indeed, theatrics were definitely not an art form limited solely to the very capable defense. The prosecution team, an equally theatrical group, also indulged in their own unique brand of dramaturgy, expertly casting Candace in the everlastingly archetypal role of the classic femme fatale. According to them, she carefully wove a complex web designed specifically to ensnare an impressionable young man, her own nephew no less, who was all too eager to please a figure he perceived as a higher power. They painted an explicit and vivid caricature of a woman who seemed to be driven by an insatiable level of avarice and an immoral compass whose needle pointed unwaveringly to her own dark and selfish desires. In an era where the lines separating celebrity from notoriety were regularly and quite shamelessly blurred and crossed, the courtroom itself swiftly became akin to a circus arena. The ongoing trial evolved into a continually captivating performance, measured by the audible collection of sharp gasps, the cascade of hushed murmurs among the public galleries, and the ferocity of the loudly proclaimed front-page headlines that grabbed attention far and wide. What unfolded was an emotionally charged combination of incredibly high drama, staggeringly high stakes, and the rapt, fixated eyes of a deeply intrigued nation, each individual transfixed and focusing on the always unfolding spectacle. The tension was not for nothing. These two distinct and unique individuals were dancing dangerously close with death itself. Florida is, of course, a capital punishment state. Both Candace and Mel faced the electric chair if the jury found them guilty as charged. For their parts, though, Candace and Mel remained charismatic defendants. Candace often met with members of the press for drinks at the end of the day, and Mel smiled sheepishly when a former co-worker told the court that he'd bragged he could get anything he wanted from Candace by giving her oral sex. The judge ordered anyone under 21 to leave, their seats happily taken by people still waiting in line outside. The all-male jury included a bus driver, a bellhop, a rooming house proprietor, a truck driver, and a piano player. One newspaper reported the jurors were transfixed by Candace. Another proclaimed the trial was over the moment she sat down in the courtroom and crossed her legs. In the end, they deliberated for 3 days before returning with a verdict of not guilty for both Candace and Mel. The two defendants made eye contact with each other for the first time during the entire trial at that moment. Then Candace broke down in tears as Mel told her she was beautiful. Acquittal from the courtroom does not simply translate to an equivalent acquittal in the stringently judgmental court of public opinion prevailing outside. Candace Mosler, emerging unharmed from the trial, found her once respected reputation inextricably tethered to the persistent, murmuring whispers of scandal. These whispers unceremoniously rippled out far beyond the usually discreet reaches of Houston's venerable high society's circles. She remained, however, a remarkably determined woman, undaunted, who, standing tall and confidently amid the dying embers of salacious, widespread controversy, sought determinedly to reforge and reinvent her public image. Despite having faced the possible end of her freedom, and indeed her life, Candace emerged, still a socialite par excellence, continuing to sway and marvel the elites of Houston with her unwavering charm and gaiety. Surprisingly, one of her first decisive actions post-trial was to take the helm of the business empire left by Jack. Candace stepped into his shoes as the chairwoman of the board, navigating the male-dominated world of finance with an air of confidence. She ventured fearlessly into real estate, snapped up apartment buildings in Beverly Hills, and even flirted with the music industry. Her entrepreneurial spirit, seemingly fueled by the scandal that shadowed her past, blazed a trail for women in her era and beyond. Behind the closed doors of her opulent mansion, however, a storm was brewing. Her adopted children, who once formed the tender narrative of her compassionate side, turned against her. Lawsuits erupted, accusing Candace of defrauding her children's trust funds. These controversies strained the familial ties, leaving a rift that money and opulence could not bridge. Candace's personal life continued to command attention and foster speculation. Her remarriage to Barnett Garrison, a man nearly 2 decades her junior, stirred the social cauldron once more. Their union, though beset by controversy and rumors of infidelity, added an intricate layer to Candace's already colorful story. The strange circumstances surrounding Barnett's near-fatal fall from the roof of their home only intensified the public's fascination with the enigma of Candace's life. The saga of Candace Mosler drew to its final mysterious close in October 1976. The once-lauded Houston socialite, whose life had been a vivacious whirlwind of opulence and scandal, checked into Miami's illustrious Fontainebleau Hotel. Like the crafted chapters of her life, her final days there, too, were shrouded in a veil of ambiguity. Plagued by a painful headache, she called upon her doctor who administered Demerol and Phenergan, hoping to alleviate her suffering. Unfortunately, Candace had already taken a significant amount of Placidol, a potent barbiturate. The combination proved fatal. Discovered the following morning in her suite, adorned in a pink nightgown amongst sumptuous pillows, it appeared as though she had succumbed to a tragic overmedication. The county coroner delivered his verdict as an incautious self-overdosage, and at 62, Candace's tempestuous life was extinguished. Speculation ran amok. Was it accidental, or did Candace orchestrate her final exit, desiring to leave behind a legacy as enigmatic as her rise to prominence? One thing was clear. Candace's wish was to lay in eternal rest beside her late husband, Jack Mosler. She had instructed her remains to be transported to Arlington National Cemetery. In death, as in life, Candace sought connection with Jack, yearning to share in the tranquility of the infinite alongside him. For more about this and all of our episodes, check out our True Crime Bedtime Stories Instagram and TikTok accounts. Join us next time for True Crime Bedtime Stories. Until then, sleep tight.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.